Good morning. You're listening to KUNV 91.5, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, J. Patrick Hooligan. You can read my columns in the Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly. My co-host, as always, Tovin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. Today and into the fall, we'll be talking a lot about the upcoming elections. To set up the final stretch run, we're joined by UNLV political scientist and friend of the program, Dave DeMore. Dave, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we just finished the national political conventions. We want to get your impressions of both. Start with the Republican convention. So go ahead.
Well, I think the Republicans had two hurdles they needed to get over with, and I don't know how well they did. The first was obviously they have a divided party. And while the party may be unified in throwing Barack Obama out, they're not necessarily all for Mitt Romney. I think we certainly saw that with the Nevada delegation and their actions at the convention there. The other problem they have, and what I think is more difficult for the out party always, is you have to be pessimistic. You have to sort of project this notion that the country's going to hell in a handbasket when voters want optimism. They want a positive image there. And so you have to strike that balance between things aren't going well, therefore we should change it and we'll make it a brighter future. And I don't know if they actually were able to do that. They were certainly able to dump on Barack Obama, which is fairly, you know, what a lot of the partisans want. But could they be able to project a sort of positive image? And I don't know that they had this sort of plan that for voters moving forward that they could sort of grasp on and say, yeah, I can see how that could work.
Mm-hmm. Matt, there's a related question. As a challenger, I remember Bill Clinton, he faced the same dilemma in 1992. The economy was sluggish. It was nothing like it is now, but it was sluggish at the time. But he put out, Bill Clinton being Bill Clinton, a vast array of detailed policy plans. It was put into a book called Putting People First. And I think they made the assumption, Democrats in 1992, that you can't just run out the clock on a bad economy and hope that people will support you. We haven't seen that from the Republicans. They haven't put out much of a detailed plan, and they're pretty open about that. They're not going to offer details because they're going to get attacked on them. Yeah. Is this backfiring?
I believe it is, because I think you saw that the Democratic convention, they were able to fill in the blanks for them, right? I think there was such a concern in the Republican convention to sort of humanize Mitt Romney, sort of reshape the narrative of who Mitt Romney is that they left a big policy hole there. And that allowed Bill Clinton very effectively to sort of say, this is what they're really going to talk about, and Obama to a lesser extent there. So they sort of, by trying to reintroduce America to who Mitt Romney is, they didn't touch on the policy, and that allowed the Democrats first to define who Mitt Romney is and then define his policies.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Republicans did showcase, I guess, at their convention some of the younger members and sort of potential maybe 2016 or future candidates. Who impressed you? What did you see from those people?
Well, obviously, I mean, I think Marco Rubio, everybody seems to think he did the best, and obviously he's a way for them to sort of broaden their base a little bit there. You know, and he's got the benefit.
The Florida Cubans?
Well, I'm just saying, you know, not a white male.
Right.
In that sense there. And he also has the advantage of not being a national politics philosophy. He doesn't have a lot of the baggage there. I don't think Chris Christie ended up doing himself many favors. I think he ended up sort of obviously stepping all over Obama. And he just doesn't come off as someone who I would really want to love there. And I think more Republicans dig into him. He's going to be wrong on a lot of their social issues, which I don't think is going to change a whole lot between now and 2016 there. So, I mean, obviously you had a lot.
Well, and Paul Ryan.
Yeah, and Paul Ryan. Obviously, well, you'll put his hat in the ring, assuming that Romney doesn't win this time around. But, I mean, he faces a lot. The problem with all those guys coming out of Congress is there's so many bad votes they've had to take over the years that, you know.
That John Kerry ran into.
Exactly. Every day is John McCain, and we see that all the time. And that's why, you know, before Obama, there hadn't been anybody from direct out of Congress since John Kennedy. I mean, there's a reason why that happens, is because there's just so much baggage that goes with that.
And Obama didn't have that long of a history.
Exactly. And he was only there for 2 years, and he didn't have much of a record as a state legislature. And so he was, you know, when people said, well, why don't you, you know, wait another cycle or wait some time? He said, well, it makes my record worse, right? I have to take all these votes in the Senate, and they're going to be used against me. So the less I have, you know, the better shape I am. And obviously he hit the perfect moment to run. On that one there. So, you know, those are the issues that the Republicans are going to have moving forward here as you think about, you know, the demographic changes we've seen obviously here and across the country. you know, those are going to just be accelerated in four more years. There's going to be fewer working white class voters. There's going to be fewer elderly white voters here, and they're going to have to figure out a way to sort of change their message and be able to broaden their appeal.
All right, let's turn to the Democrats. What were your thoughts on the convention?
Well, I thought the Democratic convention was interesting because, you know, there's a lot of parallels to the Republicans and the non-primetime speakers, like sort of throwing them at red meat. You heard a lot of social issues on both sides, which I think was a little bit of a surprise in a campaign that's supposed to be about the economy on that one there. But you saw, I think, all the advantages of incumbency on display there. And obviously the advantage of going second, both of those things helped quite a bit as they were able to sort of see what did they say, where were the holes there, and they were able to exploit sort of the lack of detail on policy
there. And not just did they go second, but I think it was a Republican, they made a mistake by going the previous week. It should have allowed some space.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But it was like an immediate response.
Absolutely. And so whatever you positive you're going to get is going to be short-lived out of that there. And so, you know, I think you saw in you know, when there was a dearth of foreign policy discussion at the Republican convention, even though that doesn't loom large, people do think about that, right? You know, you do think about those issues, and I think, you know, the Obama, they got as much mileage as they possibly could have gotten out of his foreign policy record there. And, you know, he was able to still project more optimism, right? And, you know, I think he does have the advantage in the sense that you still look at the polling numbers, and the plurality of voters are still blaming the Republican policies for the present situation. They may not be happy about the pace of recovery, but the fact that voters aren't total idiots, that they forgot what happened.
History did not begin on January 20th, 2009.
Exactly. He did not walk in the door with peace and prosperity, right? And I think voters have given the benefit of the doubt. And that's, again, where the Republicans failing to sort of say, this is what we're going to do differently. We've learned our mistakes. They more or less skipped over George Bush, not having him at the convention. Compare his role to what Bill Clinton was able to do. Not that George Bush was able to do what Bill Clinton did, but the fact that somehow we're supposed to forget that you had, you know, unified party control for like 6 years. So that was the real problem. I think the Democrats, you know, they took advantage of that. They were able to showcase the diversity of their party. And also you saw
just, not on the stage, but on the floor.
On the floor, exactly. Not just on the stage, but on the floor. And you saw a younger, more diverse crowd. And, you know, obviously not being there, you have to sort of take the media's word for it, but more energy where a lot of people have thought, well, Obama's not going to be able to mobilize. Mm-hmm. He's not going to be able to sort of get these people to vote for him again. I think just
the
opposite.
Britt Hume of Fox News said that it wasn't more energy. It was just the volume was cranked up so loud.
Disorganization.
Yeah, you just couldn't hear yourself think.
Yeah. Better acoustics.
All that enthusiasm.
Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, the Republicans wasn't a total disaster, but obviously it didn't move the needle for them, and it was one of their few chances to do that. And we're seeing, you know, we don't know how long the polling bounce Obama's going to get, if it's long-term or short-term, but he's certainly been the beneficiary of the handful of undecideds who've now made their decision in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And coming out of the convention, I mean, what do you see? I mean, do you think those bounces, if any, are going to be long-term bounces, or are we really
My sense is yes, just because there's, you know, if I felt that Romney had a bold vision for the future, if he was able to go out there and sort of say, this is what we're going to do here, and I'm willing to stand up to my party, who I know have done some things that we haven't liked, voters might have been willing to sort of say, okay, this is a moderate, this is someone who's above partisanship. But the nature of his party and the concerns of the conservatives about him has really forced him to sort of move right. And for better or for worse, he's now, you know, embraced the Ryan vision of government. He's trying to, you know, separate himself out a little bit there. But at the end of the day, it was a gift. I think that was a gift for the Democrats. They'd already been running against the Ryan budget when no one knew what it was. Now you put this guy on
the
ticket.
You elevated the Ryan budget
that polled horribly before. You know, 10% approval for Congress, and this is one of the leaders of Congress. You really got to sort of question that decision.
You wrote a chapter in a book recently, published by the Brookings Institution, about changes in demographics and politics of the Intermountain West. How are we seeing those changes play out in this election season?
I mean, we're almost seeing it play out in real time. it's pretty interesting. That's what's so exciting about studying not just Nevada, but the whole Mountain West region here, is you have these traditionally rural Republican states, sparsely populated, that are now some of the most diverse in urbanized areas in the country here. And one party saw that coming and took advantage of that. And that's why, you know, have New Mexico is now out of reach for the Republicans. Colorado, which used to be something they could count on, they're going to have to fight till the very last day for. Nevada, you know, even though the economy is so bad, you have yet to see a public poll with Mitt Romney leading Barack Obama. And that is just simply a large part of that's due, obviously, to the demographics, but the ability to put together the political machinery to take advantage of that. It's one thing to just sort of say, yeah, these demographic chains provide advantage for us, but be able to get in those communities day after day, knocking on doors, registering voters, getting those voters out. That's the nuts and bolts that wins elections. That's not glamorous, and it's the part that the Republicans had done really well. If you go back to the early in 2000 Bush campaign, the 2004 Bush campaign, McCain invested nothing in that. Now they're playing catch up for a whole cycle here, and it's really, really tough for them to do that as, you know, the demographics have moved farther away from where they were. So, I mean, they can run the same campaign they run in 2000 and still lose.
Is that where does that advantage come from? The that's just old style Democratic politics that goes back decades from labor unions, and that's just not something that Republicans were very familiar with.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look traditionally, I mean, the Democrats were the party of government, and there's never been a period in America in the last 120 years where there's been more Republicans than Democrats. I mean, when they've you know, won largely the presidency in more recent years. It's only recently that they've been able to compete at the congressional level here. Now, obviously, you know, they're getting stronger in some of the Midwestern states. Missouri used to be a bellwether state. Now it looks like it's trending Republican. There, Wisconsin, some interesting things happening there. So, I mean, there is this sort of reaction to what's going on in the West elsewhere here. But those are states like, you know, here, Colorado, Arizona, where they could count on those states. They can no longer do that. And then they have to sort of think about these choices. You have to write off Pennsylvania for the most part. You have to write off Michigan. And that's a lot of electoral college votes just to sort of hold in Arizona or Colorado.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to 91.5, and this is Neon Eden. I'm J. Patrick Kulikin. My co-host is Tovin LePan, and our guest today is Dave DeMore, UNLV political scientist and friend of the program. We're talking about the upcoming election. Now let's turn to Nevada, the Senate race. It's still apparently close, although the incumbent, Dean Heller, who was appointed to that seat by Governor Brian Sandoval, he seems to have a slight advantage at this point. Why is that?
I think there's a couple of reasons for it. The first is obviously the ethics issue, the cloud around sort of Shelley Berkley. Even though I think she sort of fought that to a standstill, it's still in every news story. It's getting hammered by the outside groups as well as Dean Heller. So I think that certainly hurts her there. I think, you know, stylistically, Berkley, you know, outside of Las Vegas doesn't play so well. And obviously she's toned down a lot of sort of the Las Vegas to her presentation.
Even in Henderson, you mean?
Absolutely, yeah. outside the core of Las Vegas here. And then, you know, she's going to do well with the core Democratic voters. How well does she be able to go out there and sort of win suburban moms and suburban dads in Washoe County and in Green Valley and up in Summerlin? That's what we don't know there. The other thing that hurts her is her best issues are sort of off the table. Foreign policy, where she can speak very articulately, where she can draw contrast with her party, you know, for voters who don't want her just to be another rubber stamp here. She's not going to have an opportunity to talk about that. So it's largely deteriorated into who's worse on Medicare.
Maybe because she and Heller are basically the same on Israel.
To some degree, yeah. I mean, yeah, she's very hawkish on Israel. Yeah. But, I mean, she has much greater depth, and it's obviously a much more personal issue for her. So it's largely deteriorated into race about who's going to cut more out of your Medicare and those types of issues there. I think she also could probably strengthen her campaign by going after Heller into some of his positions on Latino voters, something we've talked about here before. Mm-hmm. You haven't heard a lot of that. Some of those more outside the mainstream positions that he's taken there, they have perfect fodder for quick hit pieces, and we haven't seen that yet.
He signed on to anchor baby legislation, mm-hmm, right?
Where in English as the official language, yeah, and all those types of things there that is sort of seen as, you know, praised the Arizona law and those kinds of things there.
Tovin, anything in the Spanish language media? Or earned or paid media on that?
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly covering the race. And, you know, Shelley Berkley was just at the Hispanics in Politics breakfast, you know, where they bring in the cans to meet. And while it's a small group of regulars that go to that, you know, they then are part of other organizations that reach out to other people. And you do have, you know, the publishers of El Mundo there. And they've been covering the race, you know, and a lot of, and they also, in general, you know, those the Spanish language papers focus on immigration issues more. And so you will see those things. And while, you know, maybe the ethics issue is coming up a lot in English language media, you know, in Spanish, like, they want to know what your immigration policies are. And that is getting out to at least the people who are consuming Spanish language media.
Do we know, is she dropping mail pieces in, on Spanish-speaking households?
I don't know. I'm sure she will coming soon in run-up to early voting here. The other way to look at that race, though, is, you know, it's as horrible as her summer was, she's still race.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people had sort of moved that from toss-up to lean Republican here. Mm-hmm. And I think Heller's cautious. I mean, he knows, you know, that his party's, you know, particularly among suburban women, that's going to, he's going to struggle with those voters there. He's struggled in Washoe over his career. If you look at his Washoe numbers, they're not as strong as you would suspect from someone who's been elected official from up there. And of course, he's still largely unknown here. In many ways, his campaign is very similar to the Romney campaign in the sense is it's just sort of a referendum on the Democrats this time around, and we're not going to really stick our nose out there and say anything that might end up coming back to bite us. So she's getting mileage out of Medicare, getting mileage, I think, out of the Paul Ryan budget here. But traditionally, you know, you look at the breakdown of voters in Nevada, they're willing to split their tickets. Go back just 2 years ago, 20% of the electorate split the ticket from Reed to Sandoval. I don't think we'll see that much this time around because it'll be a bigger electorate and you'll get more marginal Democratic voters out. But
And she has to worry not just splitting tickets, but they go in the booth, they hit Obama, and they leave.
Exactly, as well as that, as the roll-off voters as well. So there's all those sort of concerns for her out there. With that said, as I said, she's still in the race where I think a lot of people thought she would have faded by now. But I think it goes to the weakness of the Republican Party as an organization and their ability to guarantee their candidates that we're going to get our voters out and we're going to put our resources into voter registration and mobilization. That's just something they've failed to do over the last two or three cycles.
And moving on to the other races, how do you see the race incumbent Joe Heck and John Oseguera shaping up, and how is that right now?
That's a really important race. Obviously, in Nevada, but nationally, these sort of suburban districts are going to determine who holds which party holds the House here. So, if Oseguera, I think, you know, Heck's favored just because he's an incumbent, he's got more resources. Oseguera is not well known. He's got some baggage associated with him because of his career as the sort of firefighter in that issue there.
Who knew as we tape on September 11th that this would become
a weakness, absolutely, where traditionally it's one of those things that's always great to be a firefighter until it's not. You have that. Those were, but say Oseguera wins this race here, I think that's bad news for Republicans across the board. That means they're really going to be weak in the suburban districts, not just in the
it's
West.
It's a bellwether.
Exactly, those bellwether districts. And that's kind of when I give talks about the election. I say, well, how do you know we're a competitive district? Because I say, look for the Whole Foods. Right? That's where you find the competitive districts because the demographics that Whole Foods use to put in a store are very similar to what we would think in terms of making a competitive legislative districts, and that's sort of a paper I want to write at some point.
Uber pundit John Ralston wrote yesterday that with this seeming bounce, a little bit of momentum for Obama, that this could trickle down into other races. What do you think about that?
I mean, there certainly is there, but, you know,
it certainly did in 08.
It did in 08.
It seems a little hard to believe this time.
It does. And another thing at work here is you have the new maps are in play. So voters you have a lot of open seats. There's just a lot of uncertainty out there. Even incumbents who might have been, we think of safe, now they're running in these new parts of these districts here. So there's just a lot more uncertainty the first election out of a redistricting cycle for these congressional races, for these state legislative races there. Now, with that said, certainly some of those voters are going to roll off. They'll vote for Obama, and that may be all they end up doing. In other cases, they'll get a message, you got to vote at least down in the state legislative races there. I know the Republicans are counting on that. I've heard Roberson talk about, you know, our voters will stay in the booth there and they'll vote all the way down the ticket, and that does give us some help for where there's some of these marginal voters.
Republicans are just more responsible.
There you have it. You know, the more civic.
They balance their paychecks, they go to the dentist, and they go all the way down the ticket.
So I think that is a concern here, and I think that's where you know, the door knocking and the one-to-one contact for those lower level races, which don't get the media attention in the cycle, that's where it really matters. It's I met that person at the door. I got to vote for that person mm-hmm. there. Whereas if they didn't, maybe they're just like, who state legislature, what do they do, right? They only meet once every 2 years for 120 days. Here. So I think, you know, again, that comes down to it in, again, the uncertainty associated with these other districts that the party should be leaving no stone unturned. But I think, again, you advantage Democrats here. Organization, the party level, Obama's campaign, plus the unions, I think are a better bet in this environment than just further saturating the markets of outside groups spending
TV money.
TV money.
Yeah. And I had heard from a Democratic operative who I don't think he had any reason to be fibbing, but he said there was much more coordination this time from the Obama campaign. The Obama campaign in 08 was known as going it alone, mm-hmm. and they were going to elect their guy president. They didn't really care about anybody else. Why would they have changed their attitude?
I think if you look at the map, there's so many competitive Senate races and toss-up presidential races that it just makes sense, right? Is that if you can coordinate that activity, you know, instead of just worrying about the top of the ticket, I mean, there's a lot of states, not just Nevada, Florida, Ohio, Virginia, Michigan, and the list goes on and on as to how many competitive Senate seats and within those states, competitive House seats.
It won't be much of a second term if he doesn't have
exactly.
the U.S.
Exactly.
Senate, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. Even if it's 50, all he needs is 50-50, and he doesn't have to worry about getting killed on sequestration on the health care bill. I don't think they expect the House to go Democratic, even the most optimist folks, but they will be able to cut it. And so you're ending up with a House majority of 15, 16 votes. That's almost unworkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then that way a Democratic minority might be able to nab
peel off a couple of voters in some of these swing suburban districts. Absolutely. So there is a potential. Mm-hmm. But the rules are stacked so in favor of the majority that they don't have to bring legislation to the floor until the majority of the majority wants it.
Mm-hmm. A race that is apparently surprisingly tight. I don't know how good the polling is, but it's Stephen Horsford in this new congressional district. He's the Senate Majority Leader and trailing in some polls to Danny Tarkanian, even though there's more Democrats in that district by a fairly healthy margin. Seems to me that's pure name recognition. Tarkanian is the son of the famous and infamous coach, while Horsford, well known amongst we politicos, probably not well known amongst Democrats.
No, I agree, absolutely. I mean, and Tarkanian's land lasts four cycles now, so people, I think he's an incumbent. right? No, it's name recognition. It's, again, a new district. Horsford's going to, you know, he's got his Senate seat is in that district, but, you know, that's got a pretty big, about 11% of it's rural, and he's out there beating the bushes out there as well. But, you know,
I don't know why he's bothering.
You know, exactly. Cut the margins, I suppose, hopefully. But, you know, he's just now up on TV, got a sort of a soft biographical piece there. By the end of the day here, you know, we're going to see, the question will be, will the Republican national folks come in here and spend on Danny Tarkanian?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the real telltale sign that that's a real competitive race.
Yeah.
You know, if they say, well, we can spend our money elsewhere.
Because they've got needs elsewhere.
Exactly. This is 11% Democratic advantage. This is a guy with some ethical baggage of his own. He sort of neutralizes our main mode of attack against Horsford here. I think we'll see, you know, if there's a lot of national money spent in that race, then mm-hmm. I think it's really competitive. But if it sort of is not, I think at the end of the day, the Democratic turnout will decide that.
Uh-huh. But Danny Tarkanian owes the FDIC $15 million on an investment that went bad. And it was a bank loan, and that mm-hmm. was federally insured bank deposits. That would seem like a very easy ad to cut.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen it yet. My guess is, again, there's just so much oxygen getting sucked up by Romney, Obama, Berkeley, Heller, that those races are mm-hmm. kind of holding their powder until we get in the last month here and people start tuning in that are going to sort of maybe not really thought too much about the House races there. But at the same time, you know, how do you get your message out in that environment? It's very, very tough to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, moving on, state Senate races, as you mentioned, the Democrats do have a registration advantage, but there's some competitive state Senate races. Could you run down some of the ones you find most interesting and close?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think the two interesting ones are the Summerlin seat, Mark Hutchinson versus Benny Yerushalmi. A Democratic advantage in there. Yerushalmi ran 2 years ago and lost Elizabeth House's somehow. And in this seat, where we're presently sitting, right, Joyce Woodhouse versus Steve Kirk, again, a Democratic district. Steve Kirk, a councilman, well-known LDS connections there. So Democrats look at the numbers. They're probably feeling good
about Woodhouse just, had been in the state senate.
She yeah, and she's the incumbent. Michael Roberson. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she lost to Roberson in what was a double district then. So, I mean, outside of, I think, the Justin Jones seat there to replace Halseth, I think that there are going to be some concern in the other four. And obviously you have the very interesting seat up in Washoe, right? Sheila Leslie versus Greg Brower there, a Republican advantage there. But, you know, again, that's where the Democratic organization, I think, can really help out in that race there.
Longtime member of the Assembly and
exactly.
the Senate.
And I think, you know,
Brower, and he's the incumbent.
Exactly, appointed incumbent. He took over Raggio's seat, and he's made
and
a lot of
Leslie
noise about...
resigned her seat to run against him in a new district.
And he's made a lot of noise about running for attorney general, so a lot of people say, well, why am I going to vote for somebody who's going to be there for 2 years and then run again?
Mm-hmm. And he ran for Congress and lost.
Exactly.
But he's also the former U.S. attorney. There's a lot going on there.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on. Obviously, he's a very ambitious guy there. And he lost to Sharon Angle, if we go far enough back in his history, in a Republican primary. So you have those. And then, of course, the new district down here, it looks like Scott Hammond's got a nice, comfortable lead in that versus Kelly Ross. Scott Hammond, sort of moderate Republican, won an assembly seat last time around. Now he's moving up to the new Senate seat that we got down here from rural Nevada after redistricting there. So they can feel confident about that. I think the Republicans can feel pretty confident about the Kirk versus Woodhouse race, and then Hutchinson. I think that the other two are, you know, going to be.
So there's two, and where do you want to? So two, you think favor Republicans? There's five
competitive seats. I think
Republicans need to win four.
They need to win. And I think they got to feel comfortable about the new one, right? Scott Hammond versus Kelly Ross. I think they got to feel comfortable about Steve Kirk running against Joyce Woodhouse. I think they got to feel comfortable about Mark Hutchinson. But I think the other two are a little bit of a concern, even though Washoe, traditional Republican area of the last couple cycles, particularly in presidential election years, Democrats have done very, very well up there. And I think the...
Sheila works hard.
And she works very, very hard.
Hits the doors.
Yeah. So, I mean...
It's kind of a toss-up.
Either way, it's going to be 11-10 one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. And
but that's not very brilliant analysis.
Back to the Republican Party and the statewide Republican Party. The Governor Sandoval, do we know what is he doing?
Getting out of the way.
Helping some of these races. Is he doing anything, raising money or organizing? I mean, I guess he has his own brand to protect.
I think so.
He's pretty strong.
Right? As well. I mean, absolutely. He's got a high popularity there. And I think he's had a lot of turnover in his staff. He's going to start thinking about the budget and some of the policy issues moving forward, regardless of the composition of the legislature. And Sandoval doesn't just strike me as that sort of political animal who's going to get in there and go do all the fundraising and that kind of stuff there. It just doesn't seem that that's in his MO. Now, obviously, he's going to come out and help his party there, but at the same time, does he want to wade into the Ron Paul versus establishment fight there? There's no benefit for him. And if you think back to the May convention, those same folks wanted to censor him at the party convention for signing off on the continuation of the taxes. So how much does he want to put into that? How much of the political cap does he want to come down and spend in Southern Nevada trying to get nonpartisans to rally for his party there? I just don't see that.
It's putting his hand in the garbage disposal.
Putting it eloquently there.
Yeah. All right. You have been listening to Neon Eden. I'm J. Patrick Kulikin, my co-host Tovin LePan. We want to thank our guest, UNLV political scientist Dave DeMoor. Our producer is Steven Zeller. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week.